copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
As I look at this whole thing of marriage, and I try and kind of get a sense of what we all contend with, I think our biggest problem when we come to marriage is that we have issues when we come to marriage. We have big issues, and we don't know what they are until we get married and we're with each other, and then they start to come out. And then we realize we have communication problems. We're looking at each other from different lenses. We're looking at each other from different perspectives, and we have trouble. So to kind of illustrate this, I want you to watch this video, see if you can relate to this when it comes to communication in your own marriage.
It's just, there's all this pressure, you know? And sometimes it feels like it's right up on me, and I can just feel it, like literally feel it in my head, and it's relentless, and I don't know if it's going to stop. I mean, that's the thing that scares me the most, is that I don't know if it's ever going to stop.
Yeah. Well, you do have a nail in your head.
It is not about the nail.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, I'll bet if we got that out of there...
Stop trying to fix it.
No, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm just pointing out that maybe the nail is causing...
You always do this. You always try to fix things when what I really need is for you to just listen. Yeah,
see, I don't think that is what you need. I think what you need is to get the nail
out. See, you're not even listening now.
Okay, fine. I will listen. Fine.
It's just... Sometimes it's like... There's this achy... I don't know what it is. And I'm not sleeping very well at all. And all my sweaters are snagged. I mean, all of them.
Yeah, that sounds really hard.
It is. Thank you. Ow!
Come on, ow. If you would just...
Don't!
Try to see things my way. Do I have to keep on?
Well, no matter how hard you try, it just... And you know, men are fixers, and sometimes I just want you to listen. And we're looking at these gaping wounds in the whole person's life, and they don't want it. Well, we get married with issues. We're very different people. We don't realize how different we are until we get married. And Darcy and I can really weigh in on this because see, I married an angel, and she married an idiot. We didn't know this until we got married. We just found that we were very different people, but we didn't realize. You see, I think when people are trying to fall, when they're falling in love and they're sparking around each other and they're getting engaged, don't take this personally if you're in that engagement period right now. But that's basically a time when the average person is pretty delusional. You know what that word means, delusional? In other words, they're not really dealing with reality. Because when you're trying to win somebody's heart, you're putting your best foot, your best face forward. The thing you're most interested in is them, because you're trying to win them over. And then you get married and you realize, okay, I've won them, I've got them, and now you move on and you realize that you're really kind of focused on yourself. And so, you know, for instance, I am a kind of guy that likes to go around marked. I like to go down marked dead-end roads just to make sure they actually lead nowhere. I want to make sure. Let's go down there and check. It drives her nuts. I'm a man whose dreams sometimes eclipse my ability to see them. Those dreams come true. I'm a ready-shoot-aim type of guy, married to a woman that wants to make sure that we aim very carefully. And so I I struggle with like seeing little things. I can't seem to focus in, like my car keys. I can't find them. Darcy, have you seen my keys? And it drives her nuts that I can't see them. And they might be right in the middle of the table and I can't see them. So I can't see little things. Whereas she has a hard time seeing big things like a tree that's as wide as the car. I mean, you didn't see that tree? Well, we have conflict and issues on that. She was visiting her mother, and I was taking care of the kids, and I never learned to cook But so she left basically these kind of meals behind that you just stick in the microwave and just heat up. And she had told me to get a certain type of lasagna out of the freezer to fix it for the kids. And I grabbed the wrong one. And the one I bought, pulled out of the freezer and opened up, was actually too big to get inside the microwave. It wouldn't fit in there. So I got the biggest knife in the drawer out, and I'm trying to cut it in half. But it was frozen brick hard, and I couldn't get it to get it to cut through. And I thought, you know, men love tools of mass destruction. I got something in the garage that can solve this thing. And I went out there and I got my skill saw. It's a big power saw. And I put a towel on the ground and the thing on the edge. And I just cut right through it with a skill saw, cut it in half. And I went in and microwaved the half that fit in there. And of course, the kid, she calls to see how everything's going. And our daughter, Shiloh, who we also call the informer, she tips Darcy off that Dad used a power saw to cut our dinner in half, but it fit in the, you know, so we're different people. And you don't know this going in. And so we have to work. But in spite of our issues, God has great plans for all of our marriages. You see, He created marriage as His primary vehicle for handing His love from one generation to another. Now, I just said something that some people would want to disagree with, but I'm ready to defend it biblically. But he left behind marriage as His primary vehicle for handing His love from one generation to the other. And I'm not saying that churches don't play a role in that, or biblical studies and all this stuff do it, but marriage is what frames the context of how we take on life. Marriage plays such a huge role in how kids are developed, how we think, how we process. And so as marriages go, and the health of the marriage plays so much of a role in how well people can even respond in these things. So, and I think the way you build the biblical argument, we alluded to this yesterday, and we're going to talk about it again on Wednesday, is you just go to the first chapter of the Bible. And what did God put in place? Right there, as soon as He created the universe, He put a marriage. First thing out of the blocks, He said, now have kids. And He made a family. And that has been his thing, His story throughout the Bible. So that's why, I mean, we're kidding ourselves if we're doing the work of ministry and we don't put a high priority on building strong marriages and equipping parents to raise their kids. Because it's just, we're working against all the pressures if we don't win that one. Unfortunately, I think we're living in a culture that is more concerned with weddings than they are with marriages. It's a billion-dollar industry, these wedding things. The magazines, the high-gloss, the four-color, high-end magazines that are devoted to all the stuff wedding, you know, the wedding gowns and all the stuff that goes, the industry around it, it's huge. And yet, our culture works overtime to destroy what follows the wedding. When I see how much money people spend on a wedding, and by the way, I think it's worthy of investing some money in it to make to have a nice celebration, a nice kickoff to this love story. Nothing wrong with that. If it's done within reason and within budget, sure, that's fine. But I'll see people, I mean, I'm sure in every one of your countries, you see some people that just go way overboard. And in our country, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, $50,000, $70,000, $100,000, you can see being dropped on a wedding by well-to-do people for an event that night, and yet you can't get them to sit down and let us talk about what follows. There was a couple that got married out in the Scottsdale area, and they had gone through the marriage prep program at the church, but they only did it because that's the only way you could have anybody, any ministers from our church, participate in their wedding. That was just kind of a precursor. But you could tell they were just going through the motions. And they were both well off on the start of it. You know, he was a young man, but been very successful in business, and she was fairly well off. And so they really wanted to make a statement with their wedding. And they went all out. And I mean, it was just elegant beyond belief. And they were getting married on a golf course in the Scottsdale area. Our golf courses are nice backgrounds. It'd be like you getting married in a beautiful city park or by a lake or something like that. It was very beautiful. But they just weren't interested in all the discussion about marriage and what makes marriages work and where the Bible fits in and where God fits in and spiritual issues and so forth. I don't know where they heard about this, but they heard this guy had these doves, these two white doves, and you put them in cages on each side of the front of the wedding, you know, up there at the front. And then they released these things at some point in the wedding, and these things were kind of taught to kind of fly like this up together, real beautiful, and then they kind of fly over the horizon, and some guy that owns them, somehow they fly to him, and he gathers them up, and he rents them out to somebody else. And so they thought this would be beautiful. I'm sure you've seen the unity candles, or they putting two types of sand in things, that two become one. Well, this was their big thing. So they came to the point, and they went over, and the bride got her dove, and he got his dove, and they released them. Because they really wanted to, they wanted to do something no one had ever seen. They wanted a wedding that no one would ever forget. And so, sure enough, here they go. We have a lot of hawks in Arizona. They fly very high. And they look at doves like an hors d'oeuvre. And this hawk had been up there, and when they let them go, this thing swooped down, and I don't know whether it was the bride's dove's head or the groom's dove's head that got lopped off, but I mean, it hit it so hard, feathers just flew, and here goes the head, and some blood splurted, and they just and took it and flew off over the horizon to eat it. And so one of their goals of their wedding, I think, came true. They wanted a wedding that no one would ever forget, and no one will ever forget that one. But it just shows that they were completely indifferent to a marriage. They're all about an event and making a statement through a wedding. And by the way, their marriage lasted barely over a year. And it was obvious that they were just about making impressions. And so if we don't have a plan, we're going to have trouble. Remember I said the primary goal of a parent is to connect to the heart of a child in such a way that you condition that child's heart to have a heart for God? Well, that starts with heart connection in marriage. That the primary thing in marriage is about heart connection. Obviously, we get connected at the hip and all that other stuff, but you want to have heart connection to make it go the distance. And so let's walk through your things on your outline and look at some ways that we might have challenges on this. You know, one of the problems with most Christian couples is that they're trying to have a good marriage in their own power. And I think all of us can relate to this. I think we tend to do the Christian life in our own power. So why should we be surprised that we try and do our married life on our own power and our own steam? But if love is all you're depending on in your marriage, you're going to run out of ideas and resolve pretty fast, sooner than you'd prefer, because there are huge adjustments. Let me. In fact, I'm going to rattle through five things real fast here for you. Some things that I think we contend with, no matter who we are, we contend with these in our marriage, whether we're a believer or an unbeliever. And even though we're believers, they can still get the best of us. First thing is the huge adjustments that happen in marriage that test our love. We come from different backgrounds. Darcy's father was more of a white collar. Do you know that term, white collar? He was a businessman, and he worked in government. And my father was more of a blue collar man. He was more of a tradesman. Her dad carried a briefcase to work. My dad carried a toolbox to work. Her dad went out for lunch. My dad carried his lunch to work. So her dad, his fingers always looked really nice. My dad always had dirt under his fingernails. So very different. So we come from those kind of homes. And her family was from our country is divided up into two political parties. And she was brought up in one political party type family. I was brought up in a different one. So we get married. I was brought up in a Christian home. She was brought up in a home. They did not go to church. They did not recognize God. She accepted Christ in her teenage years. So we have all these different types of backgrounds, and then values that go with that, and expectations are all part of these different types of backgrounds. It's not uncommon for people to come with, they have to make a lot of adjustments in the area of money and how they view it. One might be good at making it, one very good at spending it. And so you have difficulty on that. And by the way, I think men tend to tease women a lot about their shopping problems, and their and shopping for women is just, it's just a contact sport. It's just something they do for fun. But the statistics prove that the problem shoppers in the typical marriage are not the women. They're the men. For instance, a woman will go out and she'll shop all day and buy a blouse on sale. Her husband will disappear for an hour and buy a boat. You see, so you have to work through these kind of things, and you have to know going in that you're going to struggle. For instance, I'll show you a difficult adjustment. We get married, and I've gone to bed before Darcy, and I'm almost asleep. I'm almost in that REM type sleep and dreaming, and she gets in bed, and then she'll say something like, "Did you lock the front doors?" Now, I'm in bed. I'm almost asleep. "Did you lock the front doors?" "Well, you were the last one up." I'm thinking, you just tumble it to the right. It's not that hard. My father always checked the doors and made sure they were locked when we went to bed. "Well, get him on your cell phone. Call him up. See if he can come by and lock our front doors." So we have these conflicts. We're just normal couples struggling with these kind of things. Let me give you a second thing that I think people contend with when it comes to the things that are challenging our love, is that we're surrounded by a culture that prioritizes performance over commitment. I think this is pandemic. I think it's all over the world. Performance over commitment. I think it's fair to say that we live in a world that encourages couples to go into marriage basically with a 50-50 performance relationship in mind. You do your half, I'll do my half. See, now that automatically makes us scorekeepers. Now, how do you know when you've really, you know, it's really cut down the middle? And there's this old proverb, this old saying that says, each mule thinks his load is the heaviest, right? So no matter what your spouse is doing, you assume you're doing more. And so if you're scorekeeping and you're looking at that, how do you compensate if you don't think they're pulling their weight? You do less. "Well, I'm not going to do so much. You're not doing that much." And then they do the same thing. Next thing you know, 50-50 goes to nothing. I was performing a wedding for a couple, and do you all have a rehearsal the day before or something for a typical wedding? And sometimes you have a little dinner or something. So many times you have to have a rehearsal the day before. Everybody gathers, and then everybody goes out to dinner. And so this is a rehearsal dinner, and they invited us to go to this. And often they invite relatives that may not be involved in the wedding, but, you know, they're out of town. So this guy came in, and I think he was drunk. I think he'd been drinking too much. And he got to make a toast. They were making toast to the bride. And he basically said, "Look, marriage is a 50-50 arrangement. And you do your half, and you do your half, and may you figure out how to cut it down the middle." And so he actually said that. Well, after the thing was over, I pulled a couple of sides, you know, because if I'm officiating, I feel, once again, it's my business. I'm trying to watch out for them. I said, "Hey, you know that uncle that got up that was kind of drunk that did that thing about 50-50? Ignore it. That's baloney. If you go into this marriage with that mindset, this marriage is over before you begin. That's a bankrupt hand." What I think it caused us to do is focus in on problems in our spouse. Let me give you an example. Okay, let's say, get a credit card here. Let's say this represented what it is about your spouse that really bothers you. So if you're scorekeeping and you're evaluating them all the time, and you're starting to focus in on the things that really bother you, let's say this represents what it is about your spouse about it. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm holding it at arm's length, and I'm looking at you. I'm going to ask you a question. It isn't a trick question. The answer's obvious. Okay. Can I see you? Can I look at you right now? Yes. Now, can I? Did this change size? No. Still as small as it ever was. But if it's all I'm focusing on, it's all I'll see. That makes sense? And so let's say it bothers you that your husband takes his shoes off when he comes in the house and he just leaves them, throws them around, and that bothers you. And he might be a great guy working very hard, and he's a good dad, and he loves God, and he's trying to carry, do some spiritual point guard stuff in the home. He's a good, but this so annoys you. And let's say the wife, that's all she sees. And when he does that, it doesn't matter what else he's doing. That just so bothers her, and it just tips her over the edge. Well, we do this to one another in marriages, and see, that kind of marriage doesn't stand a chance. It doesn't stand a chance. And so we've got to get beyond those things. Let me rattle through a couple more. Marital setbacks that I think come along. A third thing that I see that get the best of us, that test our love, where maybe you have a special needs child born. You never saw this one coming. Or maybe one of you gets very sick for a prolonged period of time. Or maybe you have a parent that goes through some rough stuff and you have to care for them and have to bring them into your home. Or maybe you have a child that really gives you a lot, does a lot of, in their teenagers, rebelling. And so you don't see it coming. And see, most marriages we come into, we don't anticipate the high possibility that we are going to get our turn at something really tough in our marriage. And then when it is our turn, we don't have a plan to respond properly. And then I think other priorities, let me give you a fourth thing in my little list of quick lists of five. Other priorities often grab special focus and affection that was supposed to be reserved for each other, like our careers. It's real easy in marriage. I mean, in ministry, I should say. Why? Okay. Other priorities often grab the special focus and affection that we were supposed to reserve for each other. So we turn to in our careers and we focus in on it. Ministry, I love to put it this way. I love to call it an inexhaustible cause. When we're going to pray about our marriages tonight, and you'll probably hear me say that again to the crowd. It's an inexhaustible cause in that no matter what you do, there's always more you can do. Right? And that's why you got to know how to set boundaries on your work so you don't crowd it out, because it'd be so easy to just crowd the people closest to you, your marriage and your children, out of the equation. And it's an ongoing struggle. Or it might be careers or hobbies or indulgences. And then, of course, the standard thing that I think, not standard, but I mean one of the traps that often grabs the heart of one of the spouses is pornography. And they start to turn to pornography to gain what they were supposed to be gaining and giving to one another. And by the way, pornography, we tend to think of that as a man's problem. I don't know how you all process over there, but in America, it's a man and a woman's problem. There's two forms of pornography in our country. Tell me if it's the same with yours. You know, you have the obvious visual pornography that tends to appeal to men. And then there's the fantasy pornography that appeals to women. And they nickname it over in U.S. mommy porn, and where she's living her life inside a fantasy of these love stories and things that many times they're very erotic or graphic, of which her husband could never live up to or whatever. And so it's the same type of problem. By the way, I think that's a problem that needs to be solved as a couple, instead of, and we'll talk about it in the next section. And then the fifth thing I have on my quick list here is just our onboard selfishness. We just get married. We don't realize how selfish we are, but we are. So With that in mind, let's look at letter B in your outline. The missing ingredient in marriage, most people think, is love. For instance, when you see people that are struggling in their marriage, what do they think they need to do to solve it? Well, we need to go to a marriage retreat. Or marriage conference, going to be a Christian marriage conference, because we need to jumpstart our love. We need to get our love back. And maybe we need to go on a romantic getaway and get our love back. And I say to them, that is not going to solve anything. You had plenty of love for this marriage when you got married. And sometimes, I know them long enough, I was at their wedding. Plenty of love. So 5-10 years later, what's wrong? What happened to the love? It got all beaten up. And it didn't have anything to protect it. And so I believe the missing ingredient in marriage isn't love, it's grace. That's the missing ingredient in marriage. Because see, grace is the thing that protects the love. It's the armor that we put around it. And it all goes back to the work of God, of Jesus Christ on the cross and what he did for us. See, God brought his love and grace to the cross. We defined love yesterday. No, we haven't done it yet. We'll define that tomorrow. But grace, let's define grace today. Grace is giving somebody something they desperately need but don't deserve. And so we need to be able to give that to one another in marriage. But if I'm a scorekeeper, or if I'm trying to gain from something else what I'm supposed to gain from my spouse, then that all bets are off. And then let's look at our second major point there. We look at our spouse through different lenses, through different lenses. I see a handful of lenses that are typically brought into a marriage, even in Christian marriages, and I think you'll see that these are universal, and maybe even you can see where you brought them into your own lens, into your own marriage. The first one is what I call the me lens. Now, as you look at that, that looks like a piece of tinted glass, doesn't it? You can see through it, and you can see me, right? But I'm not looking at a piece of tinted glass. I'm looking at a mirror. This is like interrogation glass they have in police stations where you can see through the people inside, but they can't see out. They can only see a mirror. And so this is when I'm looking at my spouse, and really everything about them, I'm measuring by how it affects me, what it does for me, whether it makes me better or whether it bothers me, and I get after them on that behalf. And so this is an interesting lens in that the person that looks through this lens is notorious for using a lot of personal pronouns that should be referring to a team effort. Things like my needs, my happiness, my time, my money, my kids, my stuff, my sexual desires. And so that's how they kind of process this whole marriage thing. By the way, I think this is our default mode in life. Even take a baby. When a baby cries, they're crying. That cry is basically saying, me. I need your attention. I want something. And that me can morph into mine. And it does that early on. So I think we tend to struggle with this one a lot. Great verse. Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. It says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you looking to the interests of others. The second type of lens that I think we look through is this one here, and that's the love if lens. Now, this is a piece of tinted glass. And so things aren't real clear. They're a bit murky as we go through. Many times the love if lens is a reaction to having somebody in the marriage that's looking through the me lens. And this is sometimes a reaction to a bunch of unfulfilled promises or persons that really drains you out and works you over. And so we feel like we have a right to have conditions put on our love. And I'll treat you the way you want. If you would just once help me with the kids around here, or if you would just once, you know, show me some respect in public, or if you would, whatever, and we go on with that. And by the way, I think we feel justified because I think a lot of Christians feel that that's the way God treats us. We talked about that yesterday. And they think that that God's love is conditioned on our behavior. And if we don't behave right, that he will withdraw it. And that's not what the Bible teaches. His love is not based on that. But if we have a flawed view of the gospel and we're thinking that, then it would just make sense that we'd assume we can do that to our spouse. Let me put that one right there. You know, when you think of, I mentioned this yesterday, but Psalm 103, verse 10 says, God says, he does not treat our sins. He does not treat us as our sins deserve or repay us according to our iniquities. His love isn't coming at us that way. So why would we do that to one another in our marriage? And then the most sinister lens of all, the pious lens. The pious lens. Oh, isn't it pretty, though? All stained glass and reflecting, you know. This is one that is real easy to fall guilty of in a Christian life, especially if we know our way around the Bible and we know all the great passages of Scripture in the Bible, because then we can use the Bible as more like a sledgehammer to get our spouse to do what we want them to do. I mean, you're supposed to be the spiritual leader around here. Will you finally step up and do it? Well, what about that thing about submitting? Maybe you might want to start that right about now. Well, you're just a weaker vessel, so what? How can I count on you? And all this silly stuff that people do, abusing the Scripture to try and get that other person to do what they want them to do. You know what is behind, and by the way, I think when you're counseling people in marriage, I think it's pretty easy to convince somebody of their self-absorption and their self-protection. It's pretty hard to convince them of their self-righteousness. You know why? Because they have the Bible to back them up. They can quote the Scriptures to justify why they think they're doing what they're doing. And this is incredible pride, isn't it? But when we let our pride have center stage in our marriage, we've just invited grace off the boat. How so? Think about this. James chapter 4, verse 6, it says, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. And so that's one of the verses in the Bible. If somebody says, how do I get God's grace, or how do I get more grace? Just be humble. He says, because if you're going to be arrogant, I'm going to oppose that. And so you're going to have a hard time enjoying and experiencing and living out my grace, because grace starts with humility. Now, Darcy and I packed these three lenses in our luggage when we got married 42 years ago. No, we didn't know it, but we had them with us because, you know, you go into it kind of self-absorbed. You don't realize how much you are. And we had them all. And so we could switch them like that if we had to. Whatever one worked to get what we felt we needed in a marriage, we could use these lenses. And I'm not saying that we were bad people or something. I think if you would have seen us coming along in different levels of our marriage early on and so forth, you'd have thought, what a nice couple. And they seemed to have... And we had a good highlight reel from our early marriages. We were normal, nice people. But we were still very selfish, like so many people are. And we were selfish about how we wanted our Christian life to go. In our Christian life, we wanted to set the terms on how our relationship with God went, therefore set the terms on how our relationship with each other went. Please give me a nod if you understand anything that I'm saying, because I'm looking at you and I'm wondering whether I'm communicating anything. Does this make any sense?
Yes.
Okay. Painfully so. So we needed help. And we were like, you know, we come to this point in our life, we got to stop what we're doing. We realize how much we're doing it. We got to do something about this. And so, but once again, we approach this even on our own terms, in our own power. Darcy, come up here and help me out. Let's demonstrate maybe the problem here. At least let's try. This might be very clever, or this might be an absolute bust. And the worst thing you've ever seen two people trying to illustrate a point. I'm going to slide this over here. Let's get some blue. Okay, here's one for me. Huh? Oh, yeah, we'll try and withhold that. Okay, this is the hardest part of the illustration. We've got to blow these up. Whoops. Okay. Okay, let's say these represent our lives as a married couple, Tim and Darcy. And let's say we finally realize that, you know, our love has been so kicked around and our marriage has taken so much wear and tear, and we realize how much we're doing this, and so we say, we got to change. And I say, you know what? I am so tired of looking at Darcy through that me lens and robbing her of all the respect and honor she deserves.
And I'm not happy about what I've been doing with Tim either, looking at him through that prideful love if lens. I mean, he doesn't deserve that, and boy, does God expect more from me.
And I'm a professional at using that pious lens to use the Bible to be heavy-handed to get Darcy to do what I want her to do, what I selfishly want her to do.
Well, and I'm no amateur at that myself, but I'm going to change, starting now by trying harder to do all the right things.
Me too. I'm going to work a lot harder. In fact, you know what? I'm going to start reading my Bible every day, finally.
And I'm going to start journaling about how to be a better spiritual partner for Tim.
And I'm going to get in the men's ministry down to church and get some of those guys to maybe hold me accountable.
And I'm going to try that compliment your spouse thingy three times a day that we learned at the women's retreat.
And I'm going to stop complaining about all the shoes she feels she has to have to compliment her wardrobe.
And about my shoes, huh?
Yeah.
Well,
how about the remote?
Yeah, I'm going to stop rolling my eyes every time you and your ADHD get a hold of the remote control.
Well, then for crying out loud, I'm going to do. It doesn't make any sense. But I'm going to take those long walks on the beach with her, even though no man in his right mind would want to take a long walk on a beach. I mean, what's the point? Where are we going? Can we race somebody? Can we time it? Maybe beat yesterday's time or whatever, but I'll do it.
And I'm going to get my entertainment life under control. It's going to be hard, but I can do it. I'm going to erase all those recorded TV episodes of The Real Housewives of the European Leadership Forum.
And after a while, you just give up. It's just
too.
It's just not worth it. We tried. It's just not worth it. Let's try something else. Let's try this again. You see, those balloons, what were they filled with? Whose hot air? Ours. They were filled with us. Even though we had great spiritual intentions, they were still all about us. It's I want to solve this, but God, I want to do it on my terms. I still want to drive this bus. I still want to control. And that's how we still go about it. And so sure enough, we come at it with good intentions, but false priorities, and it gets the best of us. And we can't ever win because it's still all about us. And what we need is we need to get God's Spirit where He belongs, in center stage in our life, and sitting on the throne of our life and in control in our life, and let Him have His way with us. But I think if I just do the truth of God and all the doctrine of God, but I don't let the grace of God and His Spirit transform my heart, then it's still the same. It's Tim and Darcy trying to do marriage, even Christian marriage, even good Christian marriage, on Tim and Darcy's steam. And that's why we need to have the heart of God, not just the truth of God operating in us. Well, Darcy, I hope this makes sense to you. Thank you. Thank you. Here, I'm going to put Jesus or the Holy Spirit over here for a second. What we need is grace. And grace, in a grace-filled marriage, this is going to sound very familiar, but a grace-filled marriage is simply treating your spouse the way God treats his spouse. Does that sound familiar? Grace-based parenting, treating your kids the way God treats his kids. Well, we know who God's spouse is in the Bible. Who? What is it? It's the church. It's the church. And what did God do to prove his love for the church? Just right out of the blocks. He died for it. He laid his life on the line. He gave his son. And so a grace-filled marriage, a grace-filled view looks at marriage through the greater biblical narrative rather than just the handful of the specific passages. Let me explain this. If you picked up a typical Christian book on marriage, and I'm telling you, I have a library full of them, and there's some great books out there on marriage, but here's what they all have in common. They basically unpack some primary scriptures. Genesis chapter 1 to 3, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Ephesians chapter 5, maybe Colossians chapter 3, 1 Peter chapter 3. That's where they go, because those are the primary passages on marriage in the Bible. And that's where you learn about leave, cleave, become one flesh, leave your father and mother, and so forth, multiply godly heritage, and the lead... lead humbly and submit and all that stuff. Now, here, this book here, Grace-Filled Marriage, is very different from those. We don't go into any of those passages. Here's why. For one thing, smarter people than us have already weighed in. We don't have anything to add. They've got great people out there. Have already said all their. I think you need to be said. Here's the other reason. I know people that know those passages. They teach those passages. They obey those passages. But you wouldn't want to be in their marriage. You see, those passages appear in a grander narrative. And a love story about God and his creation, his people, that starts in Genesis and goes to the last chapter of Revelation. And the theme of that love story is his grace that he showed towards us. And so what we said is, let's take those passages are fine, but let's look at the grander narrative. And what is that appearing in? And that's about grace. And what would it be like to have a grace-filled marriage? And so that's why we need this view of this lens to look through, this nice, clear, pristine, beautiful lens of God's grace. And when we have that, It brings his spirit, and we want his spirit filling us rather than us going on our own steam. Now, our love for our spouse is to be patterned after our grace-filled God. And you can take remember the napkin we did yesterday for a parent? You can do the exact same napkin for marriage. And is that on the thing there, Corey? The point, and we actually do that in the book Grace-Filled Marriage. We talk about, let's say, an emissary from God shows up at your wedding reception. You're just about to ready to leave, and they ask you, could you kind of unpack your seamless, overarching plan for a marriage that goes a distance and is you're more in love the last day of your life than you are even today? And most of us could not tell you what that. And then he basically draws it out on a napkin. The same thing. That we meet each other's inner needs and we set each other's hearts free. We build each other's character and we aim each other at something bigger than life. It's hard to do this, though, if we're looking at each other through the me lens, the love if lens, or the pious lens. It's hard to do that. That blocks God's grace. So letter D says, God has chosen marriage as a portrait of his love for an unsaved world. Much is at stake. Among other things, you know, God wants, remember we said yesterday, or actually that was in a thing I was taught in the afternoon. And one of the things we're supposed to do is mirror God's image to a lost world. And people want to be able to look at our marriage and see an example of God's love for the church or the unity within the Trinity. And obviously sin has come into the world and makes that tough, but Jesus came to pay the price for that sin, to set us free. And yet, I found people in ministry that they say, I love God, but I'm sorry I've lost my love for my spouse. I care very much for God. I want to serve him, but we've gone cold. John chapter 4, verse 19 through 21 says, we love because he first loved us. Whoever claims to love God yet hates his brother or sister is a liar. Now, obviously, if it's that close, it's got to be spouse too. For whoever does not love these people close to them whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. And he has given us this commandment, anyone that loves God needs to love their brother and their sister. Well, let me close with this analogy. I think I put that here. I have something here, and I oh, yeah. It's in my jacket pocket, honey, down here. Colorado, it's a state in the U.S., has over 52 mountain peaks that are over 14,000 feet. And so at the top of each one of those, our U.S. Geological Survey puts this thing, this is called a benchmark. It's made out of brass. And they set it there at the pinnacle of that mountain. So if you trek up that mountain, you want to get to where this is, and you know you're at the very peak. It's made out of brass. Brass is a combination of two metals, copper and zinc. Copper and zinc. And as such, these two metals, by themselves, do not have the qualities that they have once they are melded together at 2300 degrees to a liquid state to become brass. So track with me on this. For instance, all metal is malleable. All metal can be molded, but the malleable qualities of brass are stronger and more durable than of copper or zinc. And then brass has an acoustical quality to it that copper and zinc do not have. There's a ring to brass. We make bells out of brass. If you ever played in the orchestra, there's the brass section, all the trombones and trumpets and tubas. And then, of course, the percussion section has a lot of the cymbals and things like that are made out of brass. So think of all the music that the world has received from brass, but not from copper or zinc, from brass. It also has a high tolerance for friction. They make gears and bearings and tumblers and doorknobs and locks are made from brass. It's also antimicrobial. Dangerous pathogens can't live on it, so they use it in operating rooms and in hospital rooms because germs can't exist on it. And then it's also weather resistant. It can take extreme highs of temperature down to very low, low freezing temperatures and all the wind and everything in between, and it is not affected by that. That's why they use this on top of mountains. And so God calls a man and a woman together. And there's qualities he wants to give them as a couple that they do not have as individuals. And he wants our marriages, he wants to be able to mold us more into his image as married couples. He wants us to be able to be singing his love story of the gospel as a couple that we so much louder and more beautiful than we ever could as individuals. He wants us to be the kind of people that can create the locks and the security for the children that he's given to us to hide behind. And then I think he can give us a greater resistance to sin as a couple when we work together as a team with his grace. And then as a couple, he wants us to be able to withstand all the highs and lows and the hard hits of a contrary culture that comes at us. And then think about it. When they climb that mountain and they work their way up there and taking all that time and energy to get up there, and they want to you always got to take a picture on top of the mountain. Where do you think they want to stand? They want to stand right on the benchmark there. And see, there is a generation and generations coming after us. And God wants to use our marriages to be the thing that they stand on for their wedding pictures too and their wedding story. And so God has put a lot on marriage, but I think what we need, if we want to have marriage to go the distance, is we need to incorporate his grace into the big picture. So as we work in family ministry, we can do this two ways. One is let God do something in our own marriages that maybe he hasn't had a chance to do up this point because of this kind of stuff. And let his spirit have its rightful place in our life, and then let him really mold us so much into his image that we can be that pinnacle point in culture. And I believe that God has placed marriage right up here at the very pinnacle of culture to protect it. And as marriages go, so goes everything underneath. And that's why we have got to be very serious about creating strong, godly marriages. All right, let's do some Q&A. We just got started on this. We're going to walk through the levels of that. So, and you can throw them to me, Darcy, Corey, whatever. What are either observations or questions do you have about anything we covered so far? How would this relate to the ministry that you're in and what you're trying to do? Do you think that there's a high emphasis on redeeming love or trying to repair love in marriages without the thought of where grace fits in? I mean, in your churches, is grace a center stage priority? Would it make any difference to you? Remember Corey talked yesterday that people are tactical? That's the tool stuff. That's why I think Christians are becoming Google Christians. Just give me the top three things I need to do to know how to read my Bible more consistently or figure out this or whatever, get my kids to stop hitting each other or whatever. And they're because they're tactical. But strategically, there's a strategy to determine their tactics, and there's a philosophy or a theology that's determining their strategies, right? And we were saying yesterday, what if the starting point is either incomplete or flawed? I'm not saying it's wrong. I just say it's flawed. Like fear. We talked about that yesterday. Performance. And this is really what I was talking about today in marriage. It's a performance-based Christian marriage. And so if you saw Darcy and I in our early marriage, we were performing quite well. And I think most would say, what a great couple and what a sweet, sweet marriage. But we knew deep down inside, this can't be right. So you're getting it. And I hope as we keep layering it on, you'll see, because we are going to give you real practical tools tomorrow. We're going to start showing you exactly how these things play out. But you're right. If you don't get the grace thing, then it just becomes, temporary. Yes, ma'am.
I agree.
So you say you understand grace. Your hard thing is making it happen in your own life. Anybody want to weigh in? Because I'm saying from a practical point of view, there is no practical thing until you're ready to say to God, I surrender. I can understand being annoyed by something our spouse either does or doesn't do that they shouldn't do or they should do, right? I can understand it. But then what am I going to do about it? Am I going to punish them? Am I going to withhold kindness? As soon as I do that, it's no longer what they did. It's me. And so, if they have shoes that they leave around that really annoys you, and you talk with them about it, that really bugs you, and I really wish you wouldn't do that. But if I'm now going to stew about it, if I'm going to carry a grudge, if I'm going to punish them in some way, and there's a lot of ways a wife can punish a husband for things they don't like, now that's no longer his problem. That's yours and my problem. That would be my problem, right? As an individual, I'm saying, I refuse to let God's spirit and attitude define me. I refuse it because I want to be mad at him. I want to punish him. This isn't fair. This isn't right. And see, as long as we're looking at that, we're looking at it through these lenses. And so I could come in and say, well, you read your Bible more, pray more, go to worship God. You know, those aren't going to make any difference until we individually decide this is about me. Yes, sir.
So, your permission, we're using a quote in the men's ministry in Romania that says that too many men are living under grace while they keep their families under law.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. if the family makes a mistake or something, they're responsible. They're going to pay for it. If I make a mistake as a man in my house, you know, that's fine. You know, I'm the big job, the chief Indian. Then this takes us to the sacrifice, which is a Christian virtue that's not very, very trendy these days when the ego is so boosted up. Emphasize on all your rights, you deserve, your marriage and stuff, and I think this is a serious issue to consider, and it affects the family today because we're not learning or not even have models in the society that are sacrificing themselves for their
right.
brothers. If you want to see that, the only place you can look at is the Bible.
That's right.
Because other than that, there's just a few here and there glimpses in the society. They're not many to learn to sacrifice for the good of the family.
Servanthood isn't.
Yeah. I think what you're describing there is what the finished work of Christ in us looks like. And I don't think we preach and teach the finished work of Christ. I think we teach the salvation work of Christ. And then we say, okay, then I want to define it from here that fits into my ego needs and my, you know, I love that, you know, we want to operate under grace and run our house under law. So the difference would be if God's grace really goes from here to here and your husband did something that really annoyed you, it has nothing to do. It has no way to affect your love for him, your commitment to him, your absolute desire to be a wife that is there for him. You see, that's how God responds to us. He might have consequences. And you know, for instance, when we got married, I didn't realize that I pouted a lot. You know what pouting is? Pouting. How would we describe it?
Melancholy, whine, complain.
Huh? Feel sorry for yourself, and this isn't fair, and all that stuff. And you change your mood because you didn't get your way. That's pouting. Okay? Well, here's how Darcy handled that. I did that a few times. And she said, oh, you're a pouter, right? Yeah, that isn't going to work here. Don't do that anymore. That is absolutely not going to work. You will not get the response from me you want if you're going to pout. So it's just done. I said, really? And I tried a few times. And sure enough, I didn't get any. I mean, it did not work on her. It's not going to work. We don't do that. And it was over. You know, I've tried other things to get my way, but that one didn't work. And so sometimes you just, you know, you say, hey, look, this is a very annoying thing you do. I'd really like you to stop it. But it had nothing to do with her commitment to me or love for me. She didn't say, look, until you can figure out how to not pout, I'm not going to talk to you for the next 3 weeks. No. Or I'm not going to be around you. That kind of stuff. Grace is, I know this is very abstract, but until you get it, I think everything else is just smoke and mirrors. I think that the reason a lot of people struggle with grace is because they still carry around a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, they still carry around a lot of agendas towards people that they don't want to release, they don't want to forgive, and God says, well, wait a minute, go back to the cross, and we go back to the cross a lot. What did I do there for you? This was a huge thing I did for you. Now let me do all of it, so that now you can do it for others. There's misdemeanors. You're talking about a misdemeanor in a marriage, you know, somebody leaving muddy shoes around. It's a thing that's annoying. Oh, what about a felony of the heart? You know, where somebody is unfaithful, they break covenant. You know, these are huge. And by the way, I don't think I think we'd be naive to assume that those kind of things people can get through. They can only get through if they're both committed to it. But if one is not going to repent of it, it's probably done for. Yes, sir. But
I think grace is inseparable from empathy, and empathy is exactly, you know, I can only exercise empathy if I have been there.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why we can really believe that God can give us grace is exactly because we can see that He has been there, and we can only extend grace if we have been there.
And Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 7, we do not have a high priest that doesn't understand what it's like to be us.
Yeah. So it's basically a chain of experiences that go through those agents who are conveying it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think grace is probably inseparable from experiencing the...
Right.
I mean, you have to be in the receiving end.
Yeah. And when you have been on the receiving end, then you start to look at other people's sin that come to you looking through the grace lens. So, because you know, when we are a performance-based legalistic church, it's very difficult for an alcoholic to come in there. or somebody that's really struggling with, you know, whatever, crime. Maybe they got out of prison, or they've really done some things that are... It's very hard, because everybody's looking through lenses of condemnation. But when we realize how much God has forgiven us, even if you've never committed a felonious crime that could send you to prison, the crimes of our heart. Jesus said, you know, if you looked on a woman to lust at her, you've already committed adultery. And if you hate your brother, you've already killed him, you know, that kind of a thing. And he says, I've forgiven you of that. And then it gives. Then we have this empathetic, I love the word empathetic thing. We look at him through that lens that God looks at us through. And all we see is we desire to love this person, care for this person, help them find the hope and the truth. We give them that secure love, that significant purpose, that strong hope, like God does to us.